our best moments came from when we failed. Not even failed, when things went wrong, more so than failed. And I really think it's where we built relationships really strong with clients, is they don't judge you on what happened, they judge you on how you respond.
How are you? Welcome to the Entrepreneur Experiment podcast with me, Gary Fox. Today's guest is Chris Kelly, the founder of Trackworks. His goal is to make dumb devices smart. Here's my chat with Chris.
Over the past 5 years in this podcast, I've spoken to loads of amazing Irish businesses who grew from one idea to become world-class companies, able to compete with the best on the international stage. And many of those started up and grew with the help of their local enterprise office. From starting or growing to become more sustainable or digitization, the local enterprise offices have everything to help make it happen for your business. Visit localenterprise.ie or click the link in the bio below. Okay, you know me. You know I'm massively into my health, fitness, and training. But there's one thing I haven't spoken about before, and that is a product I take every single day. It's a product called Resilience, and it's made by an Irish company called Ethos. What's kind of funny is that every single entrepreneur I meet, that is the one characteristic they have, incredible resilience. So I like that little play on words. It's a multifunctional supplement that supports cognitive function, immunity, which is super important this time of year, energy levels, and it keeps stress at bay. I also love it because it's easy. If you're bringing anything new habit into your life, it has to be easy, and taking Resilience is so simple. I simply mix it in a glass of water every single morning, and I always throw a couple of extra in my gym bag to keep them with me. It's a really tasty blood orange flavor as well. It ticks all the boxes. It has B vitamins, amino acids, vitamin C, and adaptogens like reishi mushroom and ashwagandha. So if you want to try it, I think you should. Go to weareethos.com. And because I like it so much, the guys have given me a discount code. So if you go to weareethos.com, enter Gary Fox at the checkout, you'll get 20% off, which makes taking Resilience about €1 a day, which is an unbelievable price for building some inner resilience. Check out weareethos.com. If you've been listening for a while, you'll know Iconic Offices have been my partner and home in the pod for a long time now. Working and recording in their spaces has helped support the ambitious goals of the pod, and to be honest, really helped it grow. So I partner with them to give you, my fellow entrepreneurs, the opportunity to work from Iconic Offices spaces and experience it for yourself. No fees, no catches. Simply visit the Iconic Offices link in the show notes below and enter the code GARY24 and claim your free co-working day pass, or bring the whole team with you and book a day office. Chris, welcome to the pod.
Thank you very much for having me, Gary. Appreciate it.
You did the one thing I love. Brought me a present.
Absolutely, that's it, has to be done.
That is the way to my heart. You brought me a present. What am I holding?
So that's one of our Trackworks devices, which I suppose we get into in a minute, but it's a keg device, so it goes onto kegs, track kegs for the supply chain.
I just love product, putting people bring in their product, because obviously, go watch, if you're not watching YouTube, go watching YouTube right now. I just love seeing people's products, because like, yeah, we can describe them on the pod and it can sound very cool, but I just love seeing the physical thing of like this clamps on it. So where does this go in the keg?
Yeah, absolutely. So it just goes right on the top of the keg. So
it sits flat like that. So it's kind of curved. If you are listening, it's like a little rectangular. What size? Like a little bit larger than a matchbox?
Yeah, but I think it's about 2.5 inches long, about an inch and a half wide at its widest, an inch in the shortest.
Just as a little fin at the bottom and it's curved then to fit onto the keg.
Exactly, yeah.
So what does it do?
Yeah, so it's an active or a passive RFID and NFC device inside in it. So for those that aren't familiar with RFID,
I was just going to say, NFC, what does that mean?
Yeah, absolutely. So I always use the example of a retail store because everyone's familiar with it. So you know when someone forgets to remove the tag off your clothes and you walk out the buzzers. So that's RFID that's working there. NFC, we all use it every day with Apple Pay and Google Pay. So it allows your phone to, or allows people to engage with their mobile phone with the device. And fundamentally, they're used. We have similar readers that you'll see in stores all throughout the country in all retail stores. We put them on gates, or we put them on factory lines, or we have handheld guns for delivery drivers and all that sort of stuff as well to help them to scan these assets through different parts of the supply chain.
So what are we putting them on? We're putting them on...
Yeah, so we have about 3,000 different form factors of that device we call it our library of devices. Now, we probably use about 10 of them for the predominant amount of applications.
So different versions of it, like they don't all look like this.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. So we've that's probably our most common one that we use for kegs. So we use them on gas cylinders, pallets, crates, even on packages sometimes as well, to help people to track valuable pieces of equipment up and down the supply chain.
Okay, so you can track using this thing.
Exactly, yeah. Okay. So once a reader scans it, it updates the location system.
So what does it go on then?
Yeah, so it goes on to the asset itself. So when we look at supply chain, every piece of goods that moves around the supply chain on any given day, it has to go on a vessel of some description.
Yeah.
So for the food industry, it's predominantly pallets and crates and sometimes trays for, say, the bread industry. And then for the oil and gas industry, it's predominantly pallets and cylinders. And then in the brewing industry, you'll see kegs, you'll see pallets then for bottled goods and so on. But mostly those assets will be the main ones we track.
So we have, like, obviously loads and loads of entrepreneurs and business owners listening. So for them listening, if they're kind of tracking stuff through the supply chain, this will actually do a lot of that for them.
Yeah, absolutely. So I describe it as an asset management system for downstream logistics. So I can explain what that means in simpler terms. So if you're shipping goods from your manufacturing facility or from your refilling facility, depending on the industry that you're in, we'll help you to track everything that needs to happen with that asset right down to the customer level. So whether that's just its physical location, so, or who has custody of your assets, so who's responsible for it, you'll often find that these are returnable assets. So they're owned by the manufacturer and they're supposed to get them back. That often isn't the case, or they don't know where they've gone. They can.
Why? What happens?
Yeah, so a lot of it is just the volume of goods they're shipping. So you could be shipping hundreds of thousands or tens of thousands, in some cases even millions of these assets around your supply chain for some of the larger corporates. And it's just impossible to track where they all go without having some sort of technology to aid it. People try to.
Where do they go, though?
Yeah, so they go, for example, in brewing to the pubs, and then.
No, but where do they go missing? Like, how do they go missing?
So when you ship it out, say, like a pub, they may return back 10, and sometimes there's malice in it. Sometimes it's that they've been stolen. Sometimes it's that perhaps they've just been given away to someone, you know, to help them with, I don't know, building sites, or you'll often see them with show jumping stands, or you'll see them on building sites is another common one. And a lot of it is just people not knowing that they're extremely valuable assets, whether that's a pallet or, you know, you'll often see pallets in all sorts of locations as well, but they fundamentally belong to the manufacturer, and the manufacturer's having to pay for these assets every year to create new ones. And then sometimes it's just that, for example, you may not know where they are, so you may not collect them, or you may not ask someone to give them back, and they could be just sitting in the back of either a pub or the back of a retail center or whatever the case may be.
Yeah, you do see it, in fairness, yeah. Especially older places, like, you do kind of see things just piled. I was literally in Athenry yesterday, and yeah. I was in the back of this really old, kind of like, I don't even know what you call it, guest house. Mm. It was as rare as they come, but it was just full of stuff.
Yeah.
It was just full of stuff. And you could see it had been there for years and years and years and years.
And there's a term we use to describe that effect. We call it at risk. So in our system, we never say an asset is lost, because we might just say that it's been with a supplier for, say, in the example of if a beer is 4 months shelf life or 12 months in some cases. If it's been there for more than the shelf life, we'll flag it up as we call it an asset at risk, because it may still just be at the pub and just no one knows, it hasn't been collected. But if it's out of date, there's no point in it being there. And similarly with, you know, pallets, if they're outside of the normal circulation times, we can tell them, well, look, this asset's actually kind of been there longer than it should be. And it's configurable based on each supply chain, because each supply chain is vastly different.
That's cool.
Yeah.
So essentially you're making dumb devices smart.
Exactly. Yeah. And I know I touched on it with you before about talking about all the different systems that we can bring in for people. So bringing in things like maintenance management. So if you've got like a ton of goods on a pallet, it's obviously a huge risk in the supply chain. If that falls over on top of someone because a pallet is damaged or cracked underneath it, it can be a huge health and safety concern. In the case of, you know, of any asset that's moving through supply chain, is generally going to be quite, especially the ones that we're tracking, will have heavy goods in them. So being able to ensure that they're maintained properly, being able to show accurate records of the maintenance that's been done, or in the refilling line, being able to move an asset off for testing or whatever the case may be.
It's something you'd never think of, but it makes total sense when you say it like that. When you explain it like that, you're like, yeah, that makes total sense.
Yeah.
That's so obvious when you, and it's one of those things, literally, I saw it yesterday. Mm. Like, it's funny, like, and yesterday it only just kind of like, I was like, oh, what a lot of clutter. Like, it just, that's all how I thought of it yesterday. But now when I look at it through the lens of this, I'm like, that's just so much value just sitting there, literally rotting away.
Yeah. And that's the thing as well, is that if you have these assets that are out there, you may have, you know, let's just say 10,000 if you're a small producer that you're shipping 10,000 pallets of product around the supply chain. You may only need 8,000, but because your pallets are sitting in a warehouse or sitting in a store or whatever product you're shipping, you mightn't be able to actually recover them back from the market quick enough. And you could actually, by accurately using it, tracking them down to each location, you could reduce the amount of pallets that you actually need. You can reduce the amount that you need to replace. And it fundamentally means you're spending less in your CapEx, but you're also then getting all the benefits that I mentioned around the automation of your data. I always bring up the hardware first because it helps people to visualize what we do, and it helps people to grasp the core concepts that we use to get this data. But it really is the sky's limit once you have that infrastructure in place to be able to track your assets through the different stages of the supply chain. You can automate your delivery and collection dockets. You can start understanding turnaround times in stores. So you can start to get sales data to know, well, actually, we're shipping in a pallet there a month and it's coming back in 2 months. So therefore, we can feed that data back to our production schedules and we can know that ballpark, we will need another pallet to go to that customer. Or if you're overstocking a location, you'll see that very quickly because you'll see the turnaround times for this retailer is twice what the turnaround times for this one is, and they have more pallets than this one. So if we actually shifted our stock over there, we would be able to have, you know, better sales, make sure that one doesn't get understocked. And there's an awful lot of data that comes out of it. And fundamentally, we're a software and a data company, not a hardware company, even though we do a lot of hardware that we stock and sell into customers.
You've reminded me of a PTSD story I have that I actually hadn't thought of this in a long time. When I was in co-op in UL, I won't name the company. I went to a very big tech company and my role was chemicals and gases buyer. Mm-hmm. I was doing business in UL. Yeah. I didn't even know what the fuck that was. So it brought me into a little cubicle and it was looked like this, old PC, and it looked like a DOS interface. Mm-hmm. And my job was to run these daily reports, tracking stock levels. Mm-hmm. I didn't know what they fucking were, what they look, whether it was a chemical, whether it was a gas. You'd run these reports daily. You'd order in this. It was all very low level. Mm-hmm. And I remember one Friday running the report and I'd ordered two extra containers mm-hmm. of this gas. And it was 150 grand's worth.
Wow. Yeah.
Honest to God, I went to the bathroom and had a full-blown panic attack because I was like, I don't know what this means. Does this mean a major problem? Mm. And I didn't even know what they were. I couldn't visualize because I hadn't, you see something like this, you're kind of going, well, that would have stopped that at source.
Yeah.
Probably wouldn't even have needed me on co-op for 9 months, because this would have stopped it at source. So when that penny just dropped, I went back in your mouth. I was like, don't worry about it. After
a common problem.
For an hour, I was like, oh my God. This is it. What happens now? I fail my course. I get kicked out of UL. I have to pay them back 150 grand. I have to pay them back 150 grand. Of course not.
It goes through your head, right?
Oh my God. So you're what, 20? You're like, oh my God, this is the worst thing that's ever going to happen in the world. And it made no sense because the warehouse was somewhere close by and I just didn't even know what they were. And I was just ordering. Remember, something as simple as this. Yeah. It would all be automated.
And even with that, right, even the idea of a stock check, right? So when we go into companies, people think stock check, because you see all these lovely demos, right? And you go and you see on LinkedIn or whatever the case may be, this lovely demo of these robots going up and down.
Yeah, yeah.
And they're doing this automated stock checks. And I've been to some of the companies that have these lovely demos and I've seen the demo. I mean, this is sci-fi stuff. And then I'm like, how rolled out is this? Then it's 5% of maybe their supply chain. They're like, we're never doing it for the rest because it's too overly expensive or we can't get those levels of automation. And of course, over time, that will come down. But right now for us, what we're trying to help companies do with stock checking, for example, is that now you have everything tracked, we can give someone a gun and they can pick out, say, one particular section within the yard, which again, all of the assets are when they come off, I should have mentioned that when they come off the refilling line, we can then scan them into either the warehouse or into the yard, into the different pens or different racks in the case of warehousing. So you know exactly where the product, when the product was filled, what it was filled with, and then where it's gone within your own storage facility. So that helps you to circulate the stock better. So you can say, right, we should pick this keg or this pallet because that's going to be out of date, whatever it needs to be. And what's interesting with that is if you want to do a stock check, you can pick a particular place in the system, take one of the handheld guns, go out to the yard or into the warehouse, whatever the case may be, and just scan that particular location and it'll tell you what's there, what's missing and what was unexpected. So you can do kind of a census check on all of those things as well.
How do you come up with an idea like this? Because it's pretty bloody niche.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a very very interesting journey of how we got here. We started off in hospitals tracking. Well, I suppose if I'm being honest about it, before that there was a...
Bring me all the way back.
Yeah, I'll bring you all the way back.
We've got the time.
me and Fiona Owen were... working on a dating app of all things, which I think everyone laughs at.
And, well, they either start, every entrepreneur starts with a dating app or a roommate finding app, or wouldn't it be great if you could find a roommate easier? Everyone starts with that.
Typical, right? So like we were nerds for nerds, typical, like, I don't know why we ever thought we had any specialty in the area, but we thought, yeah, we can change this. Like, you know, that whole...
What area do I know least about dating? Let's do that.
A typical rookie mistake. And we thought, like, you know, that's a real problem. It's like having to talk to people in person. Like, we're really bad at that. So like, maybe we can build like a little bit of an app to help us like find someone indoors. But what we didn't realize was what we were building was like almost like a stalker app, because you could like match with someone and then you'd be able to track each other down or whatever the case may be. And we were like presenting it at like a maker group that we were involved in Limerick. And someone said, you know what? I'm not so sure about the whole like dating element there, but I work in the hospital and we're looking at a problem at the moment. I think your technology that you're using would be really interesting for... We have a problem patient tracking. We don't know where our patients are. We issues with them, issues with, you know, finding them, understanding how long patients are spending in each phase of their care. And it's a really expensive area. And in the operating theatre complex, it's about €1,500 an hour per theatre to run. So like, we need to get on top of it. And could you come in and take a look at it? And
we're, that's so interesting.
Yeah. And we like built this algorithm that could work over the existing Wi-Fi infrastructure. So you didn't need to install any infrastructure. So it was really neat that they could just put these tracking devices or like Wi-Fi based devices.
So you tweaked the idea from dating / talking to patient management.
Exactly. Yeah. And
but this brings me on to something that I actually see a lot and I'm very passionate about, is that people are too precious about their idea in the early stages because they're afraid to tell people because they say because they're afraid someone will steal it, but really they're afraid someone's going to say, that's a shit idea.
Yeah.
And you just work on it. Whereas what you did with like just being open and honest and transparent, no one gives a shit about your idea, but you're definitely going to get good feedback. You're going to get feedback. It won't all be good. But like, it's amazing how that piece of feedback led you to your first product.
Oh, 100%. And I saw Mark Zuckerberg talk about it before. And like, again, whether you like Zuckerberg or not, I think what he said is very relevant. There's no such thing as this eureka moment people talk about. Yeah. It's like over romanticized. It's like
100%. The origin myth story. And it's 99%. I can tell, this is my rare secret. Yeah. I can tell when people are bullshitting me about their origin myth. Yeah. I can go, well, that's horseshit.
Yeah.
make a little note in my notes here going, well, that's horseshit. Yeah. You can just tell. It's too 100%. Neat.
Yeah.
And look, I get it. Companies get bigger and PR companies are telling them, oh, look, we need a story. I need a cohesive story, which you do. But sometimes it's just too much.
You lose the authenticity, I think. Yeah, 100%. Yeah. And like we had it was super fun because we were just at the time college students and just like we were just making stuff in our free time. You know, people, it was like, I think when I went to college, I found people that were really similar to me, which is great. And if you know my business partners, and it was class just being able to have that experience with them, that we were just building stuff all the time, making things, trying things.
But it should be fun.
Yeah, it was so much fun.
Business should be fun. I have a tattoo on my right arm.
Yeah.
I'll show you right now. I have a Lego man.
I love Lego. Yeah, big fan of Lego.
Because it's reminding me to build and have some fun.
Yeah.
Don't take everything so seriously.
I still make, I made like so many Lego sets over Christmas. So I'm a big Lego
fan. My wife got me Lego for Christmas. Yeah. So I'm still a Lego fan. But like, that's why I like doing this podcast because, like, there's a lot of business content and it's really boring and really serious and there's no crack and it doesn't have to be that way.
No,
like, you're going to do this hopefully for the rest of your life, and all the great entrepreneurs I talk to, they're addicts of a sort, but really just love playing the game.
Yeah,
they just love playing the game and building things. Like we had Bobby Healy in earlier and he was just talking about building and you could just see like this is one of Ireland's most successful ever entrepreneurs.
Absolutely, yeah.
Like multiple successes and exits. But he just loved, he lit up and he talked about building things.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I can relate to that so much. So much. Yeah, and I think it's, I think that there's so many elements of a business, but I think that the core of it is building. And I think if you don't, like, we'd be very much a product-led company. That's not to say we're not out talking to customers all the time, getting feedback, but it's a real culture of, like, we ship twice a week in all of our developments. And it's a new thing we've implemented over the last 6 months about, we're going to ship twice a week, every week. And it's no matter how small that release is, it's constant shipments, constant feedback, and shortening that feedback kind of cycle. And it's been challenging, right? Because
I love that.
A really short cycle.
Ship twice a week.
Yeah. And it's like, it doesn't always get shipped out to a customer and rightly so, but it's an internal shipment on a Wednesday and internal shipment on a Friday. And we sit down everyone in the office gets to use the technology, click through it, find bugs, you know, and it's a really great way of just getting it releases out, and it keeps everyone very focused on what are we building this, you know, over these 3 days, what are we building over these 2 days. And sometimes things will flow on, or we might adapt it based off what the feedback is on the Wednesday. We might say, right, we actually need to pull forward some more things, or maybe this hasn't worked.
It's a builder's mindset of building. Yeah. That's like the pod. This season, we've gone up to like two big episodes a week and a recap at the weekend because to increase the cadence, to get better at something, you need to do it more. I was like, okay, if we need to grow more, then we need to increase the output. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Need to get better guests, bigger guests. We need to grow into the UK and the US. That means just do more episodes. Yeah. It's not like, oh, I'll think about it more and I make a better plan and I'll increase the marketing a bit better. That's all fluff.
Yeah.
That's all nice to have. Do more work, put out more things.
And it's been shown in all of the research to produce better quality, which is what people don't think is going to happen. People think if I do one stable release a quarter, which is what happens in a lot of big companies, it's like we're doing one release a quarter. It just gets so bloated that it's impossible to test. It's impossible to see what the changes, what impact do those changes have. And it also forces good practices in your development. So if you are shipping twice a week, you better have a CI/CD pipeline, or you better have, you know, all integrated or you should have all your tests, you know, in place. You can have to have, you know, acceptance criteria for everything that you're doing so that there's a clear plan of how you test it after it, so that you're not spending time on DevOps, you're not spending time on, you know, having to build something as much. You have to build in all these like tools for automation. You have to build all the processes for testing so that everyone gets into the mindset of, right, we can actually spend time building now because we're not having to worry about all the other kind of...
You build the systems around it. It comes back to compounding.
Absolutely.
You're having 104 shots on target versus the company that's having four.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Like just from purely from an odds point of view, let's say 10% of them work. You're still so far ahead of even the efforts a bigger company has made to... That's why bigger companies can't innovate.
Yeah.
They just struggle in the mire and the middle management, and you know, it's just become so, like you said, bloated.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I love that. Ship twice a week. Yeah. I think that's an incredible, for any entrepreneurs listening or any even aspiring entrepreneurs, I think that's such a valuable lesson. Like just get shipping.
Get it out. Yeah.
Just building, shipping, whatever it is, it relates to every business. Just put out more stuff.
Yeah, absolutely.
The same with content, like more content. Very rarely have I worked in a business whereby I know the success formula. It's do more, obviously do better, do more guests, do more interest. Because then you get better. You go, that didn't work because of this, but I bet we can try it with this, this, and this.
And iteration is hugely effective as well. Like
that's all it is.
Even like scopes, you'd find that when you start like working on something, you have a picture of what you think it should be. And
then
you'll do an internal demo and you'll be like, oh, well, maybe we actually don't need that part now anymore because this part actually works in the way I didn't think it was going to work. Or you'll ship it out to a customer and they say, this actually fixes my problem. I don't need those other three things I said I needed. And then you've just shortened your...
And constraints build creativity.
Yeah.
The tighter the constraints, the smaller the area you have to work in. Mm-hmm. And people obviously want the bigger. They always want the more scope. Yeah. Oh, let's not niche down. No, you have to niche down.
Yeah.
Niche down as tightly as you can. And always go broader. But when you're for everyone, you're for nobody. Like that's the problem.
Yeah,
like you see that with all entrepreneurs at the start. You're so broad. You're trying to cover it. You're trying to just hit your luck distance of like just throw out a lot of shit.
Yeah.
So you went patient tracking.
Yeah. So we did that for about 2.5-3 years. I think like it was maybe a year of development and 2.5 years. We were literally lived in the hospital. Like we were there nearly 3 or 4 days a week with UHL. They were absolutely amazing to work with in terms of R&D. They're brilliant.
Tough space to go into. Was this your first business?
Yeah, very tough. You know, we didn't have any knowledge, but simple things help, right? And I think because we had no medical background, it really helped us because we were able to come in and ask the obvious question of why does it happen like that?
Yeah, blank slate. Yeah.
Why does that go that way, or what's the case there? And you're able to kind of see things a different way, and just simply like we picked up like 20 books in the hospital or in the library because we're still students in UL, and read, like we didn't fully read them, but just go through the chapters on them. Like perioperative care was the area we were in, or surgical care essentially. We just picked up every book we find in the library on and flicked through it and say, right, this chapter is probably relevant for us. Let's read that chapter. Let's take some notes. And myself and Fionn split them 10 and 10. He read through 10, I read through 10. We made a pile of notes and we explained them to each other. And all of a sudden you had a really clear picture of how it should work. And then what the literature says it should do. We then did like a small pilot with our proof of concept, even at that point, with about 10 patients. I remember being like 19, having to present to the CEO of the hospital, like the results of the study. And they were amazing. Like the chief information officer, Brian McKeown, at the time. He's now moved on to National Ambulance Service, but he backed the project. He was like, I think this is really cool, and I think it could have a huge impact.
That's so refreshing to hear as
amazing,
well.
Amazing,
like,
yeah.
That's so refreshing that, like, people always have a reason not to do things, and, oh, the health service, oh, the government, oh, people love moaning.
Yeah.
But then it's refreshing to hear, like, that they back innovation and they back young entrepreneurs innovating.
Yeah, and like, we were, like, the big thing for them was research. So they were able to, obviously, that it's now a university hospital in America as opposed to, I think it was the Midwestern region, I think, before, or whatever it was. Mm. But they have a huge research focus. So this is something new. We published a paper with them in the British Medical Journal, or the Innovations Journal, which was great to get that out there and show, like, what the system did. And it was just a really great environment to work in and to try things out. And, you know, the most rewarding part for me was there was a paper-based system there, and it's in our paper. We were able to show that within 5 minutes of every one of the paper records, our system was able to accurately match back to what the paper said. So it was, and even there's a note in the paper to say it's quite realistic that the paper is off by 5 minutes anyway. So we were able to show that actually it could be done without any paper.
Yeah.
So that was the first iteration of what is now TrackWorks, or Pinpoint at the time it was.
What were you going to do with it? Were you going to sell it to hospitals, or what was the plan?
Yeah, so we'd started working with the Bond Sclerosis Group. We were working with Liverpool Heart and Chest over in the UK as well in the NHS. And we were trying to contain it at first to be like, we're going to do, you know, a few isolated pilots, get the learnings, iterate, do the usual type of practice on that, and get the process right. We had that done at that point. So I just went over to the UK, did about 14 cities in, I think, about 2 weeks or give or take. Visited about 30, 40 hospitals in that time.
Talk to me about this. Talk to me a bit physically about that, because that is, I am adamant for entrepreneurs to do that. Like, you have to put boots on the ground.
100%, yeah.
Just tell me how you did that, because I think that's important for people listening. If you are starting physically, obviously you're on a plane, but how did you hook up all the interviews and appointments and stuff?
So we went through Enterprise Ireland in their UK office, and they were able to basically find you. They have a name for it. I can't think of the name of it. We always call it internally the Sherpa. It's kind of, they can find
Sherpa.
You.
Yeah. Enterprise Ireland Sherpa.
I don't know what the official term is for it. There is a name.
I'll put
it
in the show notes.
Yeah, 100%.
We work at the local enterprise office now, so we can hook it all up together.
Yeah. But I always call it the Sherpa. It's like, they give you this consultant who, in our case, it was Martin Bell.
That's a great insight, though. I think that's important 100%. For people looking. So go to EI, talk to them about then
what you want to do
in the UK.
Yeah, and they find you this person who gets your industry and have all the context. So he was able to, you know, hook us up with all these introductions to hospitals. And it was such a topical issue that we just sent a very short email back to his introduction and say, look, we're doing this. We kept going on our tour of the UK. We were like a band nearly, but...
I love that.
You know, we're doing a tour of the UK. We'd love to come visit you. We'll meet you at your hospital. I think that's a really important thing to make it easy for them, that don't make it hard and say, look, where do you want to meet? And, like, don't get me wrong, some of them just didn't even turn up. We had, like, you have that. You're going to have some, you might drive for 5 hours, you know, to go to a hospital, and then the person's out sick or something, you know. So you do have hit and miss with it, but I find it's extremely effective when you get to meet people in person, show them the hardware, show them all the bits and pieces. But yeah, literally went around the UK then. We had a little small, I think it was a polo or something like that. Myself and Aaron went over to visit all these hospitals, and the response was amazing. They were all saying, like, this is huge. Because, again, as I mentioned before, we didn't have to install infrastructure. So we didn't have to install readers or any of that kind of stuff, which is challenging in a hospital environment. It's great in supply chain because you know, big gates, no one really minds what you put up outside.
There's a lot of regulation as well.
Why, you could have lead-lined walls. You can't drill into them. So, you know, challenges like that come with the hospital space. So we would walk into a room, turn on a device, train it to recognize the Wi-Fi signals in the room, and then send that information back. And the response was great. And I remember coming towards the end of the Friday, we were flying back the Friday night, myself and Aaron, and we flew into, you know, COVID was starting to be a thing. It wasn't, like, fully there yet. There was a few cases in the UK. And I remember coming into Terminal 1 in Dublin Airport and, like, walking down the escalator, two people at either end with their clots in the spraying on the end of the escalators, these yellow leaflets getting handed to us, and we're like, you know, whoa, like, because the UK took a while, I think, to kind of take, Ireland was very much on it from the get-go of, like, they shut down all this, because the UK was very much a couple of weeks behind Ireland, so it wasn't even talked about over there, but back in Ireland, it was already starting to be a crisis, and it was like this immediate thing of, like, what's this going to mean for us with hospitals, and I don't know what, you know, whether it's going to be good or bad, and immediately hospitals were coming back saying, look, we can't do anything for 6 months, we're too busy. Plus the fact that you need to go into every room in the hospital to actually get your system turned on is a, you know, massive infection control risk. So it was a really weird time for us, for sure.
So what happened?
Yeah, so we initially decided we were going to contact tracing was the obvious thing because tracking, it's a space we can go into. So we
Had you raised money or how are you dealing with this?
Yeah, we'd raised $500,000 investment at that point.
Okay. So that's not easy either. Not something you can just walk away from.
100%. And we as well had a grant for about $2 million from the European Commission for building out the system as well. So it was, you know, we had a team of about 12 at the time. We were really just starting to grow. And it was a difficult decision because we were a lot of companies were just letting people go. That was a big thing at the time. And as we didn't want to do that, we wanted to kind of see what we could do. How could we pivot this? And for us, the logical step was contact tracing. Let's go after that space. And we built an app first. Then the HSE decided they were going to build their own version of the app. And we're like, okay, fair enough. But we saw a gap that there was, you know, all these factories or all of these movie studios that have staff on site for 14 hours and they're trying to stay open. If they have a case outbreak, the whole factory could have to be shut down or the whole production. So we started going out to companies, went to Reagicon down in Shannon. They took it on immediately, used Bluetooth on the device that had Wi-Fi and Bluetooth on the device already. So
what did you do? So what was it? It was like a wristband thing, was it?
Exactly, yeah. So it's like a little Apple, it's essentially an Apple Watch, but without the screen, or maybe closer to your Whoop, but a bit bigger, if that makes sense. It had all its kit inside. So basically the devices would talk to each other over Bluetooth.
Right.
And then it would tell how long people are spending together, how close they were.
So you repurposed the tracker you'd already
built. Exactly. Yeah. Rebuilt the system in, I think, 57 days, which was fairly impressive. He led it by himself because it was just so complex that he was the kind of back-end engineer in it. And then
So you pivoted straight away. You
just sort of we knew it was going to be long-term. We were in...
Fascinating.
I remember sending out an investor update, I'd say 2 or 3 weeks before it kind of all kicked off. Because we were in hospitals, we were hearing on the ground what was actually happening. And we knew from speaking to the hospitals and the nursing staff and doctors, this is going to be a big deal. And I remember sending out an investor update and I got one or two responses back. I'm like, don't worry about it. It's all going to be fine. You know, bigger things happen. I was like, that's not what we're hearing. Like on the ground, we're hearing, you know, we know this is going to be a big deal. So we immediately started, right, contact tracing. Let's get on that. Let's get ahead of it. There's something here we can offer. And then we went out to, once we had Reagicon signed up, Apple TV heard about it and said, look, we've got a production going on in Limerick. Can you provide us with, you know, tracking or with contact tracing systems for that? So worked with Apple TV. We had, I think as mentioned, Jared Harris and a few other celebrities, Lee Pace, obviously the sci-fi legend, and a few others as well.
That's amazing. So you immediately pivoted and then within couple of months had new clients in a different industry.
Yeah, 100%.
That's serious hustle.
Yeah, and I've never felt product until we moved into the supply chain area. It was a huge lesson for me because we had 6 months to 9 month sales cycles with hospitals and it was slow and you had lots of persuasion, you had lots of meetings, lots of committees. It was a really long sales process. Mm. And I immediately we knew we had product market fit because one of our clients, we did a demo with 20 devices in the morning. And they'd rung us by the afternoon to say, can we order 1,200? And I was like, that's product market fit because I knew the appetite was there.
It's the pull, not the push.
Exactly. Yeah. And we were actually, our biggest problem was actually keeping up with it, which is we knew we had, you know, being able to get the production line set up because we were doing smaller quantities, having to...
You were physically making stuff. How was that during COVID then, trying to manufacture this?
Yes, we contract manufacture everything and did it at the time as well. So it was just a matter of getting suppliers to actually just ramp up and hire more people in, essentially run more lines and get more time on machines. But we were lucky in some sense that some industries had slowed down. Sure. So we were able to take capacity in those areas. But yeah, it was mostly just actually figuring out, and that's stood to us because being able to know how to build those relationships, how to scale that up has helped hugely with the new iteration of the company, I suppose.
It's fascinating. Everything you've done is kind of built on this, you've built on every single Absolutely. Stage. Like you couldn't have predicted any of this.
No, really. 100%. No. The only thing I did say was I had a one line, and I slag everyone about it, that I had a one line in my presentation in my original deck that said possibly useful for infection control and prevention. But I had meant that in the context of a hospital, not in the context of a pandemic. But it really is just needs must, and we had to pivot. We had no choice in the matter. It wasn't that we were pivoting because we want, you know, we were almost forced to do it because of conditions that, again, Murphy's Law, would you really think a pandemic is going to happen?
There's so many lessons here though, because
100%.
The biggest lesson for any entrepreneur is just get going, just get started. Mm-hmm. Because again, what we talked about there about people being too precious about their ideas, you're overthinking everything and it'll not resemble anything close to what you think it will at the end.
Yeah, 100%.
But you just have to start and you have to get it wrong. And I think that's a big lesson for every entrepreneur is just keep just get going.
Yeah, absolutely.
Just keep, this is a fascinating story though about how it's pivoted along. So you're on Apple TV studio sets, mm-hmm. you're getting used in factories all over. What was next? Because that seems like a good business.
Yeah, and we knew...
Until it isn't.
Yeah, exactly. And we knew that from the get-go. Like, we knew it was never going to be a long-term play for us. So we were already starting to experiment in the background as well. With what limited time we had at the time, but we were thinking about that, what's the next iteration of the company. And it was one of those things that, again, we spoke to RageCon, they introduced us to one of their sister companies and said that, look, they're speaking to a gas company at the moment and they've got problems with cylinders. Maybe Vicky in RageCon, she's, I think at the time was chief operations officer, I think she's now, since the acquisition, she's the MD of the facility, but she was incredible to us as mentors. She really took us under her wing and helped us to think about the business maybe in bigger terms, and went and met with them and they spoke with this problem in the supply chain of, everyone thinks it's high tech in the supply chain, but there's so much paper. Brownfield is a term that they use to describe, you know, old sites. I think that applies to everything. The amount of manual data entry, the amount of times, and people think it's getting better and it is, but I really think if like AI and all of the machine learning algorithms, all this kind of predictive analytics, if they're really going to have an impact in supply chain, the core data needs to be captured first. And it's not being done. And that's fundamentally what we do. We capture that data for those customers. But they literally came to us and said, look, it initially was a health and safety concern, but wanting to have better processes. And we sat down with them, worked through it and said, yeah, no, we can put a device on and we can automate that whole process.
So you were kind of constantly looking, going, where else can this be applied?
Yeah.
Where else can these products be used? So you had a thesis and a theory, and then through the experimentation process of like going across different sectors and different industries, you eventually kind of hit on to making the dumb thing smart.
And this is what I think is really important when you spoke about the devices at the start. That device is no components that are common with the device that we use for contact tracing or for Wi-Fi patient tracking. And when you spoke about ideas being precious, so we initially had proposed a Bluetooth tracking system. That was the original. But when we actually spoke to the customer and started digging into it, it was too expensive. And we knew that because we started looking through it and started thinking about the problem and saying, right, if it's going to cost us 10, 15 euros at best to get a device onto, you know, a keg, a pallet, a cylinder, that's too expensive already. They're not going to buy that. It doesn't fit the business case.
Yeah.
So we flipped the problem on its head and said, what is the actual problem here? It's not that they're losing them. It's that they've no custody and they've no data. So we went back to them with a new thesis of, doesn't matter where the asset is, it matters who's responsible for it. So we can give you a device that's going to allow you to scan it into every location in the supply chain and allow you to assign the custody to who's ultimately responsible throughout each stage of the supply chain. So we can take you from whether it matters, whether you're losing 4 or 5, 6%, it doesn't actually matter anymore because you know who's responsible for it. You can build that out or you can take actions to, you know, put surcharges on whatever. And they're commercial decisions that we don't get involved in. We just give them the data over who has the responsibility for it. And that device is, you know, in volume can be sub €1, not the particular keg one, but some of our other ones that are sticker based can be sub €1. Keg ones are obviously a little bit more, given they're a bit more complex, we give metal environments and so on and so forth, but it fits the business case and it allows them to deliver a return investment within 12 months, as opposed to having this, you know, expensive device that gives them data that fundamentally doesn't matter, if that makes sense.
Yeah, you don't collect data for sake of collecting data.
Absolutely.
As cool as it is looking on a graph, unless it makes a business case. We talked about this over coffee. Mm. You know, good intentions don't make good companies.
100%.
You know, you have to have a good business case for it as well. It has to actually drop down to the bottom line.
Yeah.
If this is a cost base, if this is adding cost to the business every year.
Yeah, they're not going to do it.
It's not going to be a done thing.
Yeah. And that's what's really cool. We have a huge sustainability angle to this, that we're obviously reducing the number of new assets purchased every year. They're steel. They're obviously huge amounts of emissions and creating, whether it's a steel pallet, a plastic pallet, or a steel keg, a steel cylinder, whatever the case be, there's huge benefits to just that alone, removing paper out of the supply chain. But for me, the big benefit from a sustainability perspective is that this isn't a sustainability initiative by itself. This is a commercial initiative that helps companies to deliver returns, to get better supply chains, to get data, to future-proof their supply chains, and delivers on the sustainability initiatives while being commercially viable. Because if it's not commercially viable, I think I used the line to you over coffee that people love to say that companies should do this because it's the right thing to do, but that's not always realistic and it's not always something that companies can do. So allowing them to have the commercial benefit and the sustainability benefit, I think, is the most effective way to actually drive impact and drive change. You know?
Well, it's rooted in realism, not idealism.
Exactly. Yeah.
And that's the big difference. Yeah. And that's the big problem you see with a lot of ideas now. And it's why so many initiatives fail. They're based on shoulds, exactly like you said. They're based on this should happen. You're like, yep, but people aren't going to stop flying.
Yeah.
People aren't going to stop traveling. Like, especially the travel industry gets bashed a lot. You're like, yep. I had Dec Ryan on a few weeks ago and he was saying that, like, you know, this, like, here, this eco fuel. Yeah. He's like, yep. And I asked the guy at the conference, I was like, oh, how much can they make? And he's like, oh, it'd last Ryanair one day.
Yeah, it's not realistic, is it?
So, like, yeah, should. Yeah, it'd be great. Look, brilliant. Like, you know, super. But the likes of electric cars, like, they make sense now because the range is there.
Yeah.
Didn't make sense like 5 years ago when the range was like 190K. People are like, that'd barely do me a day.
Yeah, yeah.
As much as I would love to do it. Like, I was trying one out of there at the weekend. The range was like 480K.
Yeah.
I was like, savage.
Brilliant, yeah.
Well, that'd get me to tipping back.
Yeah.
Realistically, right?
Absolutely, yeah, yeah.
You see, you know, so like the shoulds in the woods, like, I love that. So how do you manage this process? Because that's... I'm kind of getting a sore head thinking about it, like the iterations you've had to do there in the last 4 years. How have you managed to kind of like experiment and go through? Mm. And I suppose talk to me about, like, how do you decide if something's a go or no go?
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, like, I think the most, it's funny when I think back in those times, they were probably the most stressful. My life was probably not sure what's going to happen in 6 months' time. You know, in some cases we were maybe coming towards the end of a funding cycle. So we were moving home, not taking wages for a couple of months to try and, you know, cut costs and do all those things. But I look back at them with such fond memories in another way, which is, and you know, it's funny because we had such good purpose in those times. And that's the one thing I come back to with the COVID product. Like, me and Owen would be on the phone really late at night. And I really subscribe to the Sam Altman definition of burnout, that it's a lack of purpose or lack of motivation. And it's, you've so much energy, you can't sleep. You just want, you're up early. You know, you just want to hit it again and hit it again and hit it again. And again, you're shipping, you're seeing the impact, you're getting the results, yeah. You're getting the momentum. And it's just this, it just lifts you, lifts the team, and you've this huge momentum behind you. So I think looking at them, it was very much talk to the customer, get something to them as quickly as possible, even if it's not perfect, get it out with them quickly, especially in the early stages. Again, good comms are important in that you're not, you know, over-promising and saying it's all the bells and whistles. Like, you're being very realistic, saying, look, this is our, you know, our test bed to just test this out, see how it works. And then iterate. And it's a really fun process to go through.
Talk to me on this, because I think a lot of companies, especially early stage entrepreneurs, ironically, are a bit hesitant because they're like, well, I can't get it wrong.
Yeah.
They'll think I'm an idiot. Yeah. I can't get it wrong. They'll know I don't know what I'm doing.
Yeah.
How did you get through that?
Our best moments came from when we failed. I fundamentally believe that, because not even failed, when things went wrong, more so than failed. Like, if something went wrong on a customer site, and I really think it's where we build relationships really strong with clients, is they don't judge you on what happened, they judge you on how you respond. So the fact that we were able to go out and come straight on site whenever there was an issue and say, right, tell me what's going on. Okay, we're going to work in this tonight. We'll have it fix you by the morning. Fix it by the morning. They come in and they're like, oh, that's great. It's fixed. The lads got it sorted. It's a hugely valuable thing to be aware of that and to be like, not looking for things to go wrong, but that when things do go wrong, it's more about how you respond. And it's a mentality shift of, when instead of getting panicked, and I used to do it when in our hospital pilot, I couldn't sleep at all for the whole thing. I was worried never anything went wrong. I'd be going in, the heart would be thumping, sweating on the hands, the whole lot, and be like really uncomfortable, you know, I couldn't, you know, switch off from work at all. Whereas I think when you just have a mentality switch of, right, every time there's a problem, the only thing I have to think about is, how am I responding to this? How am I fixing it? How am I doing that? And when you flip that little switch, it becomes very easy to kind of just get on with it and you actually come to enjoy it, I think, after a while. And again, not that you go looking for things to go wrong, but they inevitably do. There's never anything that goes perfect, or any project that goes perfect, but it's about how you respond to it, or how you tackle those changes or make those changes, you know.
It's always your reaction.
Yeah.
100%. It's your reaction, because shit's going to go wrong. It's your reaction to it, like, and just go, well, fucked up there. What do we do next? Or how do we just put a plan in place that it doesn't happen again?
I
think that's a huge learning as well, 100%. Because you have to plan. The response time is huge, I think.
100%.
Yeah. Like, 'cause you know, as a customer yourself, the biggest frustration you have, I think that's why people hate the utility companies and they hate this, 'cause you're like, please hold.
Yeah.
Your customer is valuable. And you get on, you're like, you explain the case and they're like, oh, I'll raise a flag for you and someone will get back to you in a week. And you're like, you don't mind it being broken. It's just you mind the reaction.
100%. Yeah. And like everyone knows of a good service when something goes wrong in a restaurant. It's like they come down and say, look, that's on the house, or we've done this, or we've given you a free drink. You're like, I'm coming back here. This is great. You know?
Exactly.
And it's the same mentality, just transferring it over to, you know, to business and to tech, I think, you know.
Customer service, like, and I think a lot of tech companies forget about that, is that you're in the customer service business as
100%,
well.
Yeah.
You know, everyone is a customer.
Yeah.
Okay, you might be working in bits and bytes, you might be working in software or tech or hardware. You're dealing with people, like, and people buy from people. People like
100%
still like to feel that reaction of like, just don't give them work.
Yeah,
I mean, I always say that, like, just don't give them extra work.
We're very lucky in our. I once described our sales process as elephant hunting, because it's like we're dealing with big multinational corporations. We have a limited customer set, so we can do that white glove treatment and really look after those customers, because again, we're not having to deal with a mass, like a consumer product where you have to, you know, have automated customer support, those kind of things. You know, we have a lot more support, or a lot more ability to be able to deliver a real white glove experience to our clients. It is a little bit easier for us. I do think it is harder if you're running like a consumer business to deliver that excellent customer service. But it's like you said, I think the response is everything to how you, or how you deal with things when they go wrong.
And how do you bring... I'm kind of curious about this, because you seem to have a good kind of customer service comms. Talk to me about the communication with the investors then, because you've had investment early. Yeah. Mm-hmm. How do you bring them with you on this journey?
Yeah, like, I think it's a, and look, we have, don't get wrong, we've gotten things wrong in times, loads of times of comms, maybe in the earlier days, like locking yourself in under a rocker and not talking about it or whatever. But just being point blank honest about it, I think that's the, or to go, I find that I have certain investors I'll go to for certain things. We have a lot of angels, a lot of VCs, a lot of, but I know what all their specialties are. So like, I know that if, you know, if there's something I want to talk about manufacturing, I'll go to either Liam or to Gary Moore or something like that, or to Barry Moore as well. Or if it's something to do with sales, I might talk to Barry Lunn, or, you know, whatever the case would be, there's specific, or if it's something to do with product, you'll always go Des, or whatever the case be, all these people that you can go to and handpick them for the specific things that they're good at.
Just a flag, that's a kind of a serious enough angel list.
Yeah,
there.
We're very lucky at our angel list for 100%.
Lucky though?
I think
is
so.
Is that
yeah.
modesty?
Yeah, I think like we were very lucky with who we met along the way. I think,
who's involved? Just for people that are listening don't know the backstory.
It's all public anyway. So like Liam Casey, Des Trainer, the Moore brothers from Steripack, Stephen Short, a bunch more as well. Barry Lunn, I don't know if I mentioned him there a second ago already.
Barry's been on the pod. Great,
yeah, great guy. Person. Yeah, 100%. He was great, like, to me in the early days. And I hate giving him too much credit now, because he'll slag me about that. But no, he was really good to us. I have to say he really does for a lot of Limerick entrepreneurs. Really helps them out in the early days of just connections. Like, and just figuring out who to talk to. Or
that's
whatever
a serious angel list. Like, to be able to have people, especially like Liam Casey and Des Trainer, like, and Barry.
Yeah, yeah.
Three of the stellar entrepreneurs, well-known, well-connected, serious success behind them. So how much have you raised then to date?
So in venture and angel funding, it's probably about 2.5. And then we've done about 2 million of a grant then, and then some enterprise earning funding as well with that. Most recent round was about just a little bit shy of 2 million.
Serious cash.
Yeah, it's good. Yeah, we're a pretty good position, thank God. Given everything's going on in the funding market, it's, you know, we're very lucky that we're now generating revenue, that we're in a position where we don't have to go out anytime soon. You know, we're very lucky that way. But yeah, it's obviously expensive running anything. That's especially when you've
expensive.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, from R&D, or whether it's engineering, or whether it's just, you know, having to front load deals or whatever the case be, but before you get paid for hardware, whatever the case be. So like, it does get expensive, but we're in a pretty fortunate position now, thank God.
So when did you realize this was it? When did you realize that we found kind of like the fit?
Yeah, so I think when I saw the scale of the problem and I started going on all these site visits, I'd say I must have visited maybe 15 or 20 different manufacturers and supply chain. And it was just the same problem, repeated.
Jackpot.
It's just like hammer, nail. And everyone, even though they were so different, I was just like, well, it's the same problem. That's the same problem. And you're not building 10 products. You're building.
So you're in research mode, where you're like, okay, the person in Regenicon, was it?
Reagecon, yes. Reagecon. So she introduced this one to gas companies.
So that was kind of, you're kind of like, okay, the mic's in here. And then you went and you like proved the concept, was it?
Exactly. So we did like an initial proof concept with that company, showed that it was feasible to do it. And then obviously challenges come up, that iterations, different features and so on. Then spoke to a bunch of brewing companies. Again, it was just lift and shift. It was the same.
Why brewing?
Because kegs are, obviously there's hundreds of thousands of kegs in Ireland. Same in the UK. There's the same problems that you're having in those industries as well. They go missing. They cost companies. I think the American Brewing Association, I could have that reference maybe wrong, but they say it's between 4% and 6% of kegs are lost every year. So it's quite significant.
That's considerable. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah. And it depends. It varies from company to company. Some are better than others, but on an industry average, that's typically what you're looking at. Yeah.
So where do you sit now with it? Like, what stage of the game are we at with the company?
Yeah. So like, we obviously last year had a lot of pilots in the early stage year. We moved into full rollouts last year, which was so exciting. Obviously can't talk with specific names of who we're working with. Yeah. We will be announcing that shortly, but it's in the hundreds of thousands of devices that we've now deployed to the field, which is really cool. You know, I was talking to you before about seeing it in one particular location where they're actually going on to assets on the line and being able to see, you know, the even that as a challenge was huge, because we had to set up our supply chain that was delivering a couple of thousand devices to then having to deliver, you know, hundreds of thousands in a 2 to 3 month period. So Fionn was obviously out in China visiting the factories, getting everything set up,
right,
going through all that process. And, you know, even then, how do you attach them? Like, so what's the process behind that? So we had to like go and design a gluing machine that would put glue on, like a 3D printer is the only way I can describe it. Put glue on the back of the tags, and then the trays would be fed into the line and then placed onto the assets. So there was a huge amount of work to just figuring that out and getting that working as well.
And you're figuring it out for the first time, obviously, every time you're doing it, trying to figure it out for the first time.
Exactly. Yeah. So it was really exciting, and you know, it's still rolling out in some facilities, and with every site it's different. There's different challenges that present at every site, and we're working through all the challenges that come up, and it's fun.
Where do you see it going? Where do you see the opportunity here?
Yeah, so for me, like, unit level data in the supply chain is the real opportunity for
us. What does that
mean? So every company in the world knows where, you know, they might have a shipping container, or they might know where a pallet is, they might know, but they don't know down to the unit level where that's gone. Or if they do know it, they have to go type up paper, they have to go into really old clunky SAP systems and, you know, delve down into the data or whatever the case may be. They don't have this information instantly available to them. So what we're getting them is the ability to know everything about that asset, where it is, where it has been, and where it should be, and what's in it, what's the product, where is that batch. So if you do a batch recall in the morning, we can immediately tell you exactly where every batch went and all of the real integral tools. And before Christmas, we did an internal demo of a chatbot with the data. And that was when we showed it to customers. You know, we went out giving initial demos to customers this month about, you can ask that now anything about your supply chain. And it's this mind-blowing thing,
because
they've gone in 12 months from paper-based systems and typing everything up into Excel, then entering that into SAP, and maybe being able to pull a bit of a report down in some cases. And it's not just SAP. Like, there's all the different, I feel like I'm bashing them now, but like, the customers use all different types of ERPs. But when the initial demos, now they're able to just take this data and extract out or ask a question. And we had one report before Christmas, which was mad, that like, we could see something was wrong in it. We're like, asked it a question, why is that, you know, wrong? And it was able to come back and go, oh, because the start time is 9, and it was actually in the previous day. It was showing like a negative on the graph, and we're able to go back and say, no, actually, can you change that?
That's huge, because more data is great and all, but it's only as useful as what you do with it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right? Because collecting all this stuff is great, but then the accessibility of data, what you just said there, is fascinating.
100%. Yeah.
Because if you're able to generate all this, and then you're able to automate how accessible it is, that's huge.
And we always say we want our companies managing by exception. So it's like, you're just managing the stuff that's outside of the norm.
Yes.
Because you shouldn't be thinking about it. If the process is running, forget about it, leave it run. It's, you know, it's going through, and it allows management to actually focus in on, and like, there's a piece to go to that. We're not fully there yet, because we need to get the full infrastructure out, which is the handguns, the readers, the tags, all the different stuff that leads that data coming back. But we are there on the other sites. We just need to basically build up enough of a data set on these sites to be able to feed that in, you know, start doing trend analysis, start looking and saying, is this out of the ordinary? You know, this, can you generate me a graph or a report to say this, whatever the case may be. So it is that new experience, right? The people, the age of the dashboard is over, I think. I think that's one thing that's become abundantly clear. You're not going generating, you know, or building dashboards for clients anymore. The new way is going to be allowing them to customize or ask for what data that they want to see back, and being able to interrogate that data, ask questions, being able to...
Talk to me about that. So dashboards are gone. Replaced by what?
I think by a language interface that does generate graphs and does generate essentially your dashboard. But I mean, when I say the dashboard, that I feel like the static dashboard that gives you your 5 KPIs that you're monitoring, know, that's an old way of thinking about it. Like, now it should become more integral. You should be able to delve down and say, I actually want the information on this piece today, or I want to know
more
this.
More granular.
Exactly, yeah. Okay. And being able to shift up and down in the data as well. So, like, you may want one day high-level statistics or summary statistics, then being able to say, okay, why is my statistic off this week? And then what's the next level of that? And what's the, and being able to delve into the problems and find your exceptions, find your things that are going wrong inside in the data. And the problem with the current process is it's all on paper, or it's not, or the data doesn't exist at all. And if you want to go gather the data, you've got to type it up into Excel. You then have to do all the stuff I mentioned before. Whereas with this, we can take that out, that pain away for you, automate that out of your processes, and allow you to just to basically focus on interrogating the data as opposed to actually, you know, gathering data and typing it up and running reports, if that makes sense.
Where does this go?
So for me, it's automation and giving the data back in the supply chain. Because if you, and what I mean by that is that, while I said we don't focus on sustainability elements, I feel like the supply chain is rampant with inefficiencies from a sustainability perspective.
Look at the global perspective now, all people are talking about is how broken the supply chain is.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And that's fundamentally for me what I think we can, the impact that we can have as a company is if we can clean up the supply chain, take out paper, stop people losing assets, stop people buying assets, you know, and really automate and deliver that efficiency, the impact that you can have on that is astronomical. Like, I read something before Christmas that I think it's about 70 or 75% of the world's GDP is in legacy industries. So medical, manufacturing, logistics, supply chain. It's like, that's actually the vast majority of stuff that's happening in the world. And if we can take that and make that better, then that's the ultimate goal for us, that we can clean that piece up in the supply chain and deliver that impact. That's for the globe, that's huge. And that's the vision for us. That's what we really want to do. And it's through delivering that unit level insights that you can actually deliver that for customers, if that makes sense.
It's a huge problem and a huge opportunity.
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah.
How do you balance this with like having a life?
Yeah. So like, it's a good question.
Cause like you're just listening, like that's a lot. Like that's a lot to deal with, overcome, and even just the momentum and the energy you've built over the last couple of years. So what's that been like to try and manage it?
Yeah, like, I mean, I think it'd be wrong if I was saying it was all rosy gardens. Like, it's not. I think every entrepreneur I've ever talked to who's, when you get talking to them honestly, will tell you that there's dark times, there's down times, all that kind of stuff. And there's no doubt that I have had those times too. But I think like it's figuring out what your way of dealing with it is. Like I've regularly, and I'm very open about, like, regularly went to counseling for the last like 4 or 5 years. It's a game changer for me because it allowed me to be a better person, allowed me to deal with stress better, allowed me to think about things in a different way.
Yeah.
It's 1 hour a week to just vent, get it off your chest, become a better person.
Yeah. I also do it, and it just clarifies my thinking.
100%.
It just gives me that time to just to think. And because I go every 2 weeks, before it, I'm thinking, after it, I'm thinking, and just, it's like a reset to like, what am I thinking? What direction am I going in? What have I built on? And where is it going?
Exactly.
And you're looking, because often you're the easiest person in the world to lie to is yourself.
Yeah. 100%.
You just go, it'll be different next time. That's why New Year's resolutions don't work, right?
Yeah.
So it's incredibly powerful. And thanks for opening up about it. Thanks for talking about it as well, because I think more people need to talk about it and just kind of, it's incredibly powerful. Like writing and counseling are the two things that I just find just clarifies, just allows the water to clear.
Yeah, well, 100%. And sport as well, I find, like exercise. I used to be really heavy. Like, not a lot of people know that. I had like a load more weight in me. And I lapsed in and out of exercise when things get busy. But like that, if you go for a run an hour a day or half an hour a day, like that, the clarity that brings that as well. And like, don't get me wrong, I've great life outside of work as well. Like, I think it's just a matter of being able to say, I've done what I can for now. I need a couple of hours to just, you know, go hang out with my friends or go to cinema or whatever the case would be, do something, go for a few drinks, whatever the case would be, and do that. I think that's it's really important. And surround yourself with other entrepreneurs as well, I found hugely beneficial, because they get it. And if it gets really lonely, you're talking to the same people all the time. And like, well, it can be difficult, you know, like you might be having conflicts, like discussions on things, heated discussions, and that's really healthy from a work perspective. But then when you go home, you're talking to other people, they don't maybe get it, you know, that kind of,
and it's also boring.
Yeah,
you also don't want to become that person. All exactly. you do is talk for fucking work. Like, you just don't want to be that person. I think 100%. It's incredibly powerful.
Yeah.
And not even in your industry, just fellow entrepreneurs that are on the same journey. I always say this, 100%. It's so important to have people around you in your circle who are on their own journey. Doesn't have to be the same as you, doesn't even have to be in the same industry, just on the same journey. They're going for the same things, because like, business is business.
Absolutely.
Like, it's all essentially the same thing. Mm. You're solving a problem for a customer.
Yeah.
The fundamentals are the same: staff, product, sourcing, finances.
Absolutely.
It's like, to have those entrepreneurs around you is, it's one of the most powerful things you can do.
Yeah. And like, find you're similar thinking as well, you know, so you get on better and you get on well with each other. So yeah, no, I find that been really good for me, just having people I can call and say, hey, look, I'm having this issue this week, what do you think? And just...
And it's shortcuts. Yeah. And you seem like a very honest dude. So like, it shortcuts once you're open and transparent.
100%.
It shortcuts a lot of things. Yeah. You don't want to be too vulnerable too soon, but like, it just shortcuts a lot of things. 100%. When you're... And like, for me, it was when I reached the point where I just wasn't trying hard anymore. I was just like open and honest going, I don't have a fucking clue.
Yeah.
And then suddenly you're like, oh yeah, well, actually I didn't know that either. And then, but I can connect you to Ben, or I connect you to this person, and then they'll
Absolutely.
Be able to... Like, it's just so freeing. When you stop trying, when you Absolutely. Stop trying to be something you're not, when you stop pretending.
And you've all these people looking out for you then as well, which is funny, because like, some of my friends would like ring me and be like, oh, hey, I was in with this customer today. Opportunity here for you.
Kind of, it's like, unreal. And they'll sell you better than you sell yourself.
Yeah, 100%.
They'll be the people who like, yeah, you need to talk to Chris, and they can like sell you better.
And it applies to investment. It applies to sales, all of the above. You know, you get the ability to get all that information from them, you know, it's great. It's hugely beneficial. Underrated, I think, to some degrees.
What's the next 12 months? What are we looking at?
Yeah, so we're deploying now in Ireland, the UK. So that's the next 12 months for us, are laser focus and execution. So it's just getting tags on assets, delivering it out to the market. And that's really the next 12 months for us. And again, scaling up. I always describe, we scale up three ways with our customers, because most of our customers are multinationals. We're scaling geographically with them, so into other territories. We're scaling in features, because there's, you know, they might be only using track and trace right now, but then they'll start using maintenance management, then they'll start using all the other feature modules. And then the other way is across other assets. So whether it's, we might be just doing, you know, gas cylinders, then we'll, or might be just doing pallets, and we'll move into covering the other assets as well. So for us, it's internally in our own current client base, expanding that way, and then expanding into other new greenfield sites, particularly in the food industry. We're doing a good bit there and a big push at the moment on that. So that's the next 12 months for us, just laser focus, getting as many assets tagged, getting as much feedback as we can from the market, and driving it on so we can do a further field launch then in 2025.
Chris, rapid fire round. What book would you recommend every entrepreneur read?
So I have the cliche answer of Hard Thing But Hard Things. I think everyone says that one.
Shoe Dog and that one are the two.
Yeah, and Marty Kagan, Inspired. I think it's a really good book as well.
What's that one?
It's a book about a product book by Marty Kagan. Really good.
Marty Kagan. What's it called?
Inspired.
Inspired. That's a new one.
Yeah, it's good.
I'll let you off for the cliched one. Just give me a good one for the second one. What's the biggest thing you've learned about yourself since you started being an entrepreneur?
My mother actually gave me a great quote in this last summer. I'd moved home. Stuff was tough at the time, and summer before last. And she said, I just got another no from an investor. I was like, I know what I'm going to do. And she just said, next logical step. So I think that's one of the best things I've ever learned, is just just do the next thing you can do and just keep going with that. So that one and that one.
Yeah, I like that one. It's like the other version of how to eat an elephant. The two things I enjoy. What valuable business is no one building?
Deep in retail, in terms of automating retail, I think there's a huge opportunity there. So like, every time I go into Dunn's, I get so frustrated at the length of the queues, or like the amount of trolleys everywhere, and it just overstimulates me completely. I hate the supermarket. So I think someone needs to automate that it's like, the better in, I do believe in a retail experience, going there, picking up your goods. But you know, when you see the Amazon stores that they've done in the US,
they're cool, aren't they?
Really cool, yeah. So like, but I think doing that at scale, they've done it in small locations. Yeah. I'd love to see someone achieve that at scale. I think it's a huge opportunity.
It does seem logical, to be fair.
Yeah.
What would you do today if I give you 10 million euro?
I love this question, and I think it's a hard one to answer too. But I think we talk about it internally, like what our goals are, and it's optionality. I think that's what 10 million would give you in the morning, is that you can focus 100% on the things that you want to focus on. So what that would be, I don't know. But one thing I will say is, I'd love to help other entrepreneurs the way I've been helped by the likes of Barry and Liam and Des and so on. Stephen Short as well, been huge to us. So I'd love to be able to go into that space of being able to just work with entrepreneurs and do it. If you had 10 million, you could do it selflessly. You're not doing it for returns, you know. So I think that's one thing I'd love to do as well.
Nice. What's something in your daily routine you wish you started sooner?
Exercising. Yeah, I was very bad for it in the early days of the company. First 2 years, I don't think we would have trained at all, let's say, and would have ate very unhealthily. But definitely the exercise, I think, has been huge for the last few years. And it doesn't have to be that major, just gym or a run or whatever the case may be.
It's time for yourself.
Yeah.
I'm going to give you 1 million euro. You can only invest it in one person or company.
Yeah.
What is it?
Luke Mackey in Cota, yeah, 100%. Or Conor Laverty and Weah, another great company. They'd be the two, I'd say. They're really, really good. And it's more the person than the business. I think they're like, I think I like both spaces they're in, but just two great entrepreneurs there.
If you just start a new company in the morning, what would it be?
I would definitely do the retail space, 100%. I think automation of retail will be huge, because even just how you think about the resources that go into, like, the amount of people on tills, amount of costs of running point of sale systems, all that kind of stuff. It's, and the value of that data, if you look at marketing pointy and how valuable that data set was, like, what could you do if the whole thing was automated? You know,
it does feel, I don't want to bash Dunnes, but it does feel, my local shop is Dunnes. I shop there all the time, so I'm not bashing them.
It's awesome.
Just, yeah. There's so much stuff going on. Yeah. It's just like yourself, I kind of like, shit, there's so much happening. Yeah. There's like stuff everywhere, and like, it's just relentless.
And it's not just Dunnes.
Feels like the Truman Show. Yeah. No, it's every yeah. shop. It just feels like the Truman Show. I'm just in Dunnes because I live beside them, and I can, not beside them, but I can live close by and I can see all the stuff that goes in and out. It just must be so hard.
Oh,
you know, there seems to be a lot of areas there where it's just so physically demanding and so tough.
100%.
Yeah, automated stacking of shelves. I always think that's an interesting one, filling it from behind.
100%. Yeah.
There was in Neenah, there was an off license and it used to be filled from behind. Not the most innovative town in the world, but I always used to go, that makes so much sense.
Yeah.
Just like, you see them behind, just like shoving stuff forward. I'd genius.
I'd love to go into like the detail of it and like get into the economics of it and how it all makes sense. Like, there's the business case and that would be fascinating, I think.
Yeah. Devin Hughes is a good friend of mine from By Me, and like, we'd go for walks during COVID and he'd just be like giving me master classes on how it all works. It's just so interesting. I'm just such a nerd when it comes to that sort of stuff. I'll watch like those videos on Amazon or on YouTube of the Amazon warehouses and like stuff going on shoots, and like, I'll watch it for like 20 minutes.
100%.
So interesting.
Exact same.
There's just so much stuff going on. I think there's so much stuff in the world. You talked about there about legacy. We're at a really interesting point whereby so much stuff is still done by hand, and so much, we're talking about AI this and AI that, and you're like, there's so much to do before we get to there.
100%.
And you're the first person to actually point that out. And it kind of frustrates me because I'm like, you're not all AI companies.
Yeah.
Come on.
Yeah.
Like, everyone in 2024, AI company, dot AI, dot AI. You're like, we have about 30 steps to go for a lot of companies before we even get there.
And I know we're short in time, but just to add to that, I think what's like Mark and Pointy described him before, is that what they had in Pointy was a data capturing mechanism for an ever evolving data set. And I thought that was a really cool way of describing what they did. And I think that they're a great example of what you can do if you can capture the core data, like the applications of it are huge. So I think that's the
key thing.
Yeah.
It's interesting you brought them up. They were brought up already in the previous episode.
Amazing entrepreneur. Yeah,
yeah, really. We had him on. Really interesting guy. But I think the innovation is interesting there because they didn't make it hard.
Yeah.
They just figured out, where can we insert this in? Too many people think of these grand schemes of like, oh, it's going to be in you know, this massive big database going to collect anything that brings friction or work.
Yeah.
You've seen it yourself. Like,
people don't
want to do it.
Yeah.
Don't give them more work. What do you believe that other people would find strange or strongly disagree with?
That everything is and it depends. So when you look at like,
everything is and it depends.
And context is everything on any.
It's such an Irish answer.
Yeah. And it depends. You know, like, if you have,
how do I get to Cork? It depends where you're starting from.
Exactly. but I think that like, if you have every phrase that you ever think of, some, like, don't take it as gospel, like, understand the meaning behind that, understand what they're trying to get at, the actual core of what someone's saying, as opposed to taking it as like a statement, I'm going to live by that. I think that
we all want that.
100%.
We're all looking for the answer.
Yeah.
That's why these pods are long, because there's no short answer.
No,
I believe I'm taking the piss out of you, but I believe what you're saying, because it's like advice. Yeah. I always say that people are like, oh, I'd like your advice. I'm like, well, I'm the worst person. I just ask questions.
Yeah.
I ask people for advice all the time.
Advice,
biggest thing about advice is, take lots of it and apply 1% of it.
Yeah, yeah.
Because no one has the answer for you. Because for exactly like you said,
it depends.
It depends.
Yeah, yeah.
Got a cracking answer. What do you spend money on in your personal life that brings you immense happiness?
I'd have to give you the most recent example, and I'm definitely influenced by Luke Littler, was a dartboard. The crack we've had with a dartboard now, I can't describe it to you. So I have a lot of games in my house. Like, I have an old pool table and darts board, the whole lot. But yeah, more enjoyment from that now, I think, than that I bought in a long while. It was like 50 quid for the board and darts. Best one I've had in a long while.
Isn't it funny though? Like, you know, you can get all the new toys you want, but like, Lego,
yeah,
a dartboard.
Simplicity, yeah.
Simple things. Get you off screens as well.
100%.
What's your final piece of advice for every entrepreneur listening?
To start. I think that's, and I know it's cliche and it's probably not what everyone wants to hear, but just get going, iterate, and don't be afraid to ask for help. And like every problem that everyone's experienced, like there's 100 people that have had it. And so some of the best, I've been very lucky to meet some of the most incredible entrepreneurs, and they'll all tell you stories. Like when you talk to them about all the ways that they messed up and all the things that went wrong along the way. And when you actually open up to them, they're more likely to open up back, and you get a huge amount of benefit from that. So start and talk to people the whole way. I think that's the most important piece.
Love it. Chris, where can people learn more about Trackworks and yourself?
Yeah, absolutely. So we're on all major social media. So either on Instagram or Twitter or LinkedIn, predominantly, I suppose, given the industry. And we're going to be launching a new website shortly, which will have loads more detail. Our website's fairly bare at the moment, but it's trackworks.ai. We'll be launching at the end of the month and have loads of details about all the new features we built over the last 12 months. But yeah.
Best place to connect yourself then?
LinkedIn, Instagram, Twitter, and on the mall generally, but whichever one, on the mall.
What's your full name for people listening?
Chris Kelly.
Chris, pleasure.
Thank you very much, Gary.
I hope you enjoyed today's episode. If you did, please hit subscribe on Spotify, Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts, as it really does help the podcast grow and reach new people. If you want to learn more about the podcast, go to mrgaryfox.com. I'll see you back here in a couple of days for a brand new episode.